Why is it important to tell true stories about the past? It is a question that people are grappling with in the United States today as uncomfortable issues like the legacy of slavery come to the forefront of public debate. In fact, all around the world, people are examining the accuracy of traditional narratives around colonialism, war, and the origins of the socioeconomic order as we know it. It is a difficult exercise, one that might first appear to be opening old wounds rather than healing them, particularly at a time when political and economic anxieties, alongside unprecedented changes in technology and human migration, appear to be threatening to unspool the fabric of society. But author Minjin Lee insists that we must persist in telling true stories about the past because they inform us about who we are and our relationship with one another. They become the very foundations of building a more peaceful and tolerant world. Korean Context caught up with Minjin Lee at the 2020 Korean American Day celebration in Washington, D.C., where she was recognized alongside fellow author Alexander Chi as this year's honorees for their contributions to American literature and for elevating the voices of Korean Americans in the United States. With no further delay, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yong Kwon, and you're listening to Korean Context. We have with us today Minjin Lee, the author of the great novel Pachinko and also Free Food for Millionaires. Thank you so much for being with Korean Context today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The reference point for a lot of American audiences about the interwar period is Great Gatsby, jazz, the Harlem Renaissance. And Pachinko is set in a very unfamiliar setting for many American audiences, the interwar period in Korea, the colonial period. And yet the book was met with incredible fanfare. People from President Obama, The Guardian in the United Kingdom. Did you find that around the world, as you meet many of your fans, that people love the book for different reasons? Did you find that Scots were finding something else attractive about the book from Americans and from Swedes and from the English?
I'm so surprised. I continue to be surprised. I marvel at the openness of readers around the world. And I think that because I'm a reader first and a writer second, I understand how readers think. Readers are specifically interested in story. So if you give them a story, a true story, not a situation, not just a premise, then I think most readers will go with you. I think what happens lately is that very often situations are presented as stories, and that's not necessarily true. So I've been incredibly overwhelmed by the response. I'm really grateful, but I'm not that surprised in the sense of people wanting to read more about other people, because that's what readers really want. They want to get out of themselves. And I've written something in which they have felt they're definitely not Korean, they're not Japanese, they're not Korean Japanese, but they want to know more. And I think real readers are, we're united by a curiosity. So in that sense, I feel really grateful that this has met their curiosity.
Of course, this has also been met with incredible fanfare from the Korean-American community. But it's also a story that I feel that Korean-Americans have been not very exposed to, the story of the Japanese Koreans. What was the response like from Korean-American community?
A lot of Korean-Americans were very grateful to me, and I felt really surprised by it. And they have reached out to me. They continue to reach out to me, and I read the letters. I'm very moved by their sentiment. Very often, even though it's about the Korean-Japanese people, they connect with the immigration thread of the book and also persecution, because so many of their ancestors, as well as themselves, have been discriminated against in this country and elsewhere. I think just being a minority, a statistical minority, and if the majority is different, very often people understand what it's like to be different. What's really troubling about the Korean-Japanese experience is that they were institutionally discriminated against, which means that the government was really against. There were laws against the Korean-Japanese people. And I think that for the most part, the laws that the Korean-Americans have had to endure, which were discriminatory, were against all minorities. So, for example, let's say miscegenation laws that really affected in the 20th century for anyone who wanted to marry somebody outside of their race. So in that sense, I think people do connect with being the outsider. And because I wrote about the outsider, I have had people from, let's say, Holland or Germany or Poland say things like, oh, I connected with that thread and they're not Korean.
And both of your novels have really sparked conversation about the immigrant community, as you mentioned, and also about the specific experiences of Japanese Koreans
in Japan. And I think it's coming at a very timely moment where we are redressing a lot of, you know, the colonial experiences of not just the Koreans, but peoples around the world. So it's an incredibly timely and important book in our society. What do you think the role of books are in general? Like, what do you see the role of the author and of novels in society?
Well, I'm a very political person, and I want to be political. I don't want to be public very often. However, I find that my books are the best way for me to be public and political. And yet, they have a Trojan horse format of literature. And I wanted it to be really interesting to read and fun to read. So if it's not fun to read, you're not going to read it. So I don't want my books to be in any way like eating spinach, although spinach is delicious. However, I think that I don't want it to be medicinal. I want you to really enjoy doing it. And then if it makes you think more about immigration, of being an outsider or refugees, then great. But above all, books have a role in the world of providing compassion for those who we're not like. And I feel that I have been trained and changed by books to be compassionate towards people who I've never had the experience of. And I think that's really exciting to be part of that world.
If we can speak about that experience of you being changed by the things that you read and learned about, you did not actually know about Japanese Koreans, the Zainichi Koreans, until college. Is that correct?
That's right.
And the Korean community living in Japan, you actually went to visit them in pursuit of researching this book. You, of course, are also of the Korean diaspora. Did you have any expectations going into Japan? And were there some expectations that were met? And were there some presumptions that were proven false?
Oh, absolutely. There are so many things I was wrong about, because I went to Japan in 2007. So before 2007, I had read a great deal of scholarship about the Korean Japanese people. I read sociology, economics, anthropology, law, and I'm really glad I did. And I read a lot of history. However, the theses that academics propose about their work in their respective fields, very often they have an agenda, and they're correct. However, you don't necessarily get the human experience. So very often what I found is that I'm really glad I read all the scholarship and they were all completely correct. However, it made me have assumptions of their victimhood. I really thought, oh, these are poor people who've just suffered. Isn't that a shame? And or I would feel really angry. It's like, how can they treat people this way? So it was either I would veer between sympathy and indignation. I went to Japan in 2007. Decades after I had started to understand this topic. And when I met the Korean Japanese, they were not acting like victims at all. Like, their attitude is, I am many things. I am Japanese. I'm Korean. And as a matter of fact, very often they had been heartbroken when they had gone to South Korea, thinking that they'd be received warmly, when in fact they were not. And I think I speak about this because it's really important. If South Koreans and if Koreans around the world expect to be treated with warmth, expect equality, we too must be warm and equal in the way we apply civil liberties. And I think that's a very American idea that I'm sharing.
One of the stories that I felt very pained about in Pachinko was one of the key characters is investigating this case where a Korean-Japanese child was bullied. Mm-hmm. And I learned from your interviews it's actually based on a true story.
That's right.
Are there any other stories in Pachinko that are true that you integrated into the novel?
So I could almost drop a footnote on every page of the 490-page book in which I am taking it from a law, I am taking it from an interview, I'm taking it from a sociology data set. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of research, for example, on the caloric nutritional distribution of the war for the Korean-Japanese people, as well as the Korean people and the Japanese people. So I even studied at that level of particularity and in a granular way. And that's something that I really enjoy. And then I would put it into the book. So I read a lot of war diaries of Japanese housewives. And that really affected the way I understood how ordinary people behave during war times. Because ordinary people during war times are not thinking about what does the military think, what does the leadership think, what does a monarchy think. They're thinking, how am I going to eat today? Like, what am I going to eat today? Right. How do I feed my family? And also, can my husband keep his job? Like, those are the kinds of questions that ordinary people face. And in that sense, the Japanese and the Korean Japanese had a shared humanity. And that was really important for me.
And that's a theme that is repeated throughout Pachinko as well, that it isn't just a story about Korean-Japanese suffering. It is about the broader experience of being isolated, about being discriminated, not just based on your ethnicity, but maybe your sexual orientation.
And disability.
Disability, right, mm-hmm. being a divorcee. Mm-hmm. I mean, these social discriminations, which I thought were a very powerful aspect of your novel.
Oh, thank you. It makes me really angry. There's so much inequity around the world, and so much of it's avoidable. Mm-hmm. We don't have to be this way.
No, absolutely not.
And these are choices that we make every single day by our behavior. And I find it heartbreaking that I'm 51 years old, and I'm seeing how Generation Z and the millennials have to witness the world breaking down. And these are choices that we continue to make. And that's something that I think that, as an older person, I have to speak out against.
Going back to your research in Japan, could you, for our listeners, tell us about one particular experience, if any come to mind, that really left an impression on how you saw the Japanese-Korean experience?
The thing that really struck me in all of my interviews with the Korean-Japanese people were very often, nearly every single person I spoke to, and I spoke to dozens of people, a very long interview, sometimes for days. The thing that I would hear is very often many would say to me, I don't feel discrimination against me. And I would think, that's amazing. How do you feel that way? And then they would start giving me personal stories of how they couldn't rent an apartment, or that their friend wouldn't invite them to their homes if they were Japanese. And then I realized, oh, what they think of discrimination is something significantly more serious. They don't think of things where slights or lack of invitations or discrimination in housing as even actual discrimination, because they had lived with it for such a long time. And then I realized my sense of entitlement about equality is so much greater than the average person. And I think it's because I'm an American.
Again, drawing from some of the interviews that you gave before, I read that the third act of the book, the story about the Korean-Japanese investment banker in Tokyo and who faces kind of these discriminations, was one of the first ideas that you developed for the novel. Was this also a true story that you drew from?
I met a lot of bankers and people who work in the finance industry who are Korean-Japanese. And when you meet them, they look just like you and me. They look like people who are educated in the West. They dress neatly, they can function well in the world, and no one would ever think they're somehow different or they came from a bad situation. They're also really careful. And sometimes, very often, they wouldn't even tell me that they're Korean, ethnically. So all those things happen, but then the more I would interview them, the more I would understand, oh, they're constantly enduring these slights and social discrimination. And social discrimination is significantly harder to prove versus legal discrimination, where you say, oh, that law is unfair by its face. Rather, when you say something like, if someone isn't invited to an outing, but you know those outings are terribly important in terms of promotion track, or if you're not seen as somebody who is coming from, quote unquote, a good family, but what does it mean to come from a good family?
Right.
So if your entire ethnic origin, those people aren't considered good, then you could never come from a good family.
Right.
So those kinds of things would happen all the time. Or let's say there's a lot of tokenism, where they would say, oh, we don't discriminate against the Korean Japanese because we have two people in our office of 5,000 who are ethnically Korean. Mm-hmm. And they would trot them out like some sort of poster children. And those people are put in a terrible situation because how could they speak out against that?
Right.
So I find that for me, because I'm an American of Korean descent, I do feel like I want to talk about this. I feel like I do think it's important to say tokenism does not mean equality. It doesn't.
I guess in this instance, the superficial discrimination is actually the legal aspect of it, the things that are visible. And then the structural discrimination is, as you describe, the more encoded, unspoken, implicit discrimination that is very much well and alive.
And it's very present in America against Asian Americans. I mean, the absence of promotions and management responsibilities that are denied to Asian Americans in this country, you can see the data sets. It's actually quite present. And yet, I think Asian Americans very often, not all, but many, are told they shouldn't speak out about it. They shouldn't stick their heads up, and they just keep studying and working hard and expecting promotions, when in fact that isn't always going to happen. And if you look at boardrooms, and if you look at managerial spaces and the C executive suite places, you're not going to see a lot of Korean American leadership and Asian American leadership. And I think that's unfair.
And you do touch on this in your first novel a little bit, in The Free Food for Millionaires. And you do touch upon it in the third act of Pachinko. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, what led you to break away from this original idea and take the story all the way back to the origins of the Korean-Japanese family, back to the colonial period?
I needed to test this hypothesis as to whether or not the legacy of racism, the legacy of ethnocentrism and xenophobia in Japan still existed today. I knew that the people who were working in finance, who still made good salaries and had white-collar jobs, their lives didn't look anything like their forebears. Nevertheless, I saw a very strong thread socially and legally as to what their ancestors had to endure. So I'm really glad if things are better for people of color around the world and for colonized people around the world. That's a good thing. However, have we reached the place where we are being treated equally, fairly, and honestly, especially the honestly part? Like, are people going to deny that this is happening? That's very important to me. And I feel like as a writer, I can speak about it, and I want to.
The entire time I was reading the third final act of the novel, I was reminded of Masayoshi Son, the founder of SoftBank, who is of Korean-Japanese descent. And simultaneously, I was reminded that, you know, there are still political scandals in Japan when Korean Japanese people who were born in the country, who were raised in the country, give financial contributions. It creates a problem because they're technically outsiders providing
Good
money.
Corner.
Right. So you have, as you mentioned, incredible success on the one hand, but still the legacy of extant discrimination. Pachinko is also very much a story about women, a story of very powerful, very resilient women. And it's also a story about the suffering of women, and not only Korean women, as we discussed a little bit, who perhaps bore a greater share of the burdens of Japanese colonial rule and then discrimination as members of the diaspora in post-war Japan, but also Japanese women. I'm reminded of the characters like Mrs. Totoyama and Etsuko, who themselves face prejudices, not because of their relationship with the Koreans, but just based on their role as mothers of people with disabilities or a divorcee. Accordingly, I also read that you initially wanted to title the novel Motherland, which did end up as one of the subtitles of the novel. Could you speak on the motif of motherhood and womanhood in Pachinko and how you approached it as you wrote this novel?
I am a feminist. I make no bones about that. I'm very proud to be a feminist, and I want to encourage all young people, male, female, whatever you identify as. And I guess for me, what's really important is that when you are a woman and you are a woman of color, you have the double burden of dealing with difficult things. And I wanted to focus on the suffering of Japanese women as well. Especially, I wanted to talk about money. If you don't have money, like if you are a very wealthy Korean woman, you have a different life than a very poor Korean woman. As a matter of fact, if you're a very poor Korean woman, your life is very different than a very, very rich white woman. I think for me, as women, to have a uterus and the reproductive responsibility or the opportunity to be a person of reproductive value, it causes an enormous number of problems in all countries. And I think that for me, just to focus on the Korean Japanese women who are suffering as well as the Japanese women suffering, I wanted to unite that level of sisterhood of what they have to endure. And I also wanted to talk about the sacrifices that they make for the next generation. So much sacrifice, which is really unvalued in the history books. How much do we talk about the work of our grandmothers? And how much do we talk about the value of illiterate women? There were so many poor illiterate women who really worked very hard for their sons and daughters, and yet no one sings their praise. And I wanted to recognize it in drama.
Absolutely. And those are powerfully and very tangibly and viscerally captured in Pachinko. And if the listeners have not read it yet, I highly recommend you pick up the copy immediately. And I'm glad that you mentioned the class aspect of all this. And it's a reoccurring theme throughout your novels, not just in Pachinko, but also, of course, in Free Food for Millionaires, as the title might suggest, and also your short story that was featured in The New Yorker called Stonehenge. And I found that to be very powerful. Could you speak on what prompted your exploration of interplay between class and race? Because this begins, I presume, before even your exploration of the Japanese-Korean experience. This goes back to the very origins of your career as a writer. I mean, what prompted it?
I think that growing up in a blue-collar neighborhood in Queens, New York, and also my parents were middle class in South Korea, not ruling class, and my mother was a piano teacher, and she worked at home. She gave lessons to neighborhood children. My father was a low-level executive in an advertising division of a cosmetics company. You know, they just made ordinary income, but it was nothing noteworthy. When they came to the United States, they had no money, and the first business that they ran was a newspaper stand in an office building in Manhattan. And then we lived in a pretty horrible apartment when we first got to the country. And I remember all those things. And yet, I didn't feel poor. Like, I didn't ever think that I was poor because everybody around me was poor. And I think that's a kind of a wonderful experience. Whereas I've met many people who grew up very wealthy, but because they were the poorest person in the wealthy neighborhood, they're always kind of like walking around like, I don't have something. And I think poverty is a state of mind, but it's also a reality of the limited choices that you have because you don't have money. But I want to talk about class, and people don't talk enough about how right now in South Korea, still, we have such class disparity and the long history of hierarchy based upon education and class still impact average South Koreans today. So I think about that a great deal. I want to write about it. And also, what does it mean when they leave South Korea and why they leave South Korea? Do they leave South Korea because they didn't feel that they had opportunities to rise? Do they go to Brazil or Canada or Australia or the Philippines or Singapore and China, all places where I've been, where I've actually spoken to Koreans in the diaspora? And it's really common as to why people go. They often go for education. They often go for newer opportunities. Or they go for sometimes civil liberties, where they felt, oh, I can't say certain things in South Korea, and therefore I had to go there. I had a politically difficult time because of an ancestor. Like, so you hear these things, and I think, wow, Koreans are everywhere, but there's a reason why Koreans are everywhere. And I'm really interested in what that means for all of us. But class is very often a huge marker. But class, not just in terms of money, as you know, but because of Confucianism, it's based on education class.
Which I understand is also the theme of your upcoming novel. Mm-hmm. Would you speak a little bit about that?
Sure. I've been working on this book for a really long time, and I've been researching it. And it's about Koreans around the world and what education means to them. And it's such a central value for Koreans around the world. As a matter of fact, I would argue that Koreans around the world and Koreans in Korea care more about education than anything. More than money, more than jobs, more than looks, more than pop culture, more than anything. They are obsessed with it. And whether they value it or devalue it, they have very strong feelings about it. And I wanted to write about what that means. I mean, I'm very concerned about elderly poverty in South Korea. Mm-hmm. It is among most damaging things about this great country. And apparently the reason why there's so much elderly poverty is because as younger people, they were spending so much of that money on their children's education.
Right.
And almost irrationally.
Right.
And I think that I want to talk about that. I want to talk about how can we take care of our elders and also to think rationally about what education should mean and what our expenditure should be. So again, I'm talking about class, I'm talking about race, I'm talking about
right.
what we care about.
I wanted to ask one final question,
sure.
which is, it's very important to discuss these issues. It's very important to talk about the suffering of people whose stories have not yet been written about. We spoke about the importance of discussing discrimination at all levels. At the same time, we spoke about how the dangers of tokenism as well, and I feel like we're at an era where we're desperately seeking. There's a demand for immigrant stories. There's a demand for stories about class struggle. There's a demand for stories about discrimination. As readers, how do we become more responsible? How should we approach and make sure that what we're addressing is, in fact, you know, something that's true to human experience and that it's not simply for the purpose of tokenism in society?
It's a really, really valuable question what you're saying, because I think it's so important that whatever I do, I mean, I'm 51. I mean, how much longer am I going to live? Let's say 20, 30, 40 years. Hopefully, most of that healthy. So part of my job, I feel this very strongly, is to empower the next generations. And they really do need to know the truth about what things, of how things happened. And yet, I don't want them to feel like whatever I say is like medicine, like you have to do this. Then it just becomes another edict which they want to ignore. I have to invite them. And the way I want to invite them is through a narrative. And learning how to write narrative that's inviting, that's another level of skill and something that I work on, I have worked on for 30 years. So I would like within the paradigm of narrative is to have an inclusive, inspiring, and empowering narrative in which people say, this is what's happened to me or to my forebears or people in my community. And I would like to feel like I can make more art. I can speak up. I can participate in different kinds of things. My first book is an indictment of capitalism. Now, most people think, oh, Casey Hahn, she's a girl who likes to spend a lot of money. But what they forget is that she's a girl who spends a lot of money and gets into a lot of trouble because she spends a lot of money. In the same vein, all 19th century novels, you had characters who really couldn't manage money. And I wanted to write about it with people in my community because I see that all the time. I see how materialism is really damaging Koreans around the world and the pursuit of money. So when I write that, I think my reader can say, if he or she is Korean, and they can be anything really, I want them to consider what it means about the way they spend their money. Like, I believe in beautiful things. I think it's wonderful to want nice things, and I want everybody to have them. In my world, the kind of democratic socialism that I would like to see is for everybody to have good things, not for none of us to have good things, because surely anybody who studies history understands that very often, in practice, communism becomes a form of totalitarianism. So clearly, I don't support that, because I believe in, as an artist, we need to have a great deal of freedom. However, to answer your question, I really want to empower the next generation to be as strong as they can be. And also, this is where it gets a little weird. I want them to be good. I want people to do good things, not just to be empowered, because just to be empowered is not enough. But to do good things in the world, to do things that build things, not destroy things. And that requires a great deal of self-control. So can we have knowledge and self-control and perseverance and higher moral values to think about our communities? That's a life's work. And I hope that I do that. I hope that I live up to those values.
That's it for our episode today. Many thanks to Minjin Lee and to you, listeners, for tuning in. You can find her novel Pachinko and Free Food for Millionaires wherever good books are sold. If you have not had the chance to listen to our interview with Minjin Lee's fellow Korean American Day honoree, Alexander Chi, we highly recommend you check it out. We will post a link to our conversation with Alexander Chi in the description of this episode. While you're with us, we would really appreciate you leaving us a rating and a comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. They help get the word out about KEI and Korean context. We would really appreciate it. We'll be back next week. See you then.